right, we are back. Episode 2 of the Crossover Conversations podcast. We are your hosts, the Wyatts. I'm Devin.
I'm Katie.
We are here to talk all things WNBA, pop culture, the crossover between the two. But before we get started, Katie, I think I need to make a confession.
What's that?
In our episode 1, the premiere episode, I kind of made a mistake. I referred to our podcast as the Courtside Conversations podcast twice, which is incorrect. We are the Crossover Conversations podcast, so I apologize. I'm new to this podcasting game, and I made an honest mistake.
Yeah, we're still trying to figure out who we are.
Yeah, we're rookies. We're rookies in this league.
We are.
And speaking of rookies, let's get right into the podcast, into the first segment. We have the sideline sagas, then and now. Well, there's kind of a lot of things going on in the WNBA this week. The first one that I think has made the most news was this Caitlin Clark, Kennedy Carter debacle, I guess.
Scuffle,
yeah.
Like, you can even call it that.
What's your take on that?
I think that Kennedy, I just think it was not necessary, but I also think that the media made it a bigger deal than it was supposed to be. Today, Caitlin said in an interview that she doesn't take it personally. She doesn't need an apology. She knows that in the heat of the moment, people do things, and she's done it too. So I think that's really all we need to cover for that.
Yeah, and even Cameron Brink, not involved whatsoever, but she made a comment in the media, I believe it was yesterday, basically that, hey, you know, this vets versus rookies narrative that's floating around is kind of ridiculous, guys. Let's cut it out.
Yeah, I think it's ridiculous too. I think the media hypes it up. I personally do feel like some of the vets in the league are a little irritated that they've worked so hard in the last several years, and now the WNBA is getting attention because of these rookies who are mm-hmm. coming in.
But
they're benefiting from it.
Oh, 100%.
I know so many vets now that I would have never known if it weren't for the rookies. So I do think there's a little bit of jealousy there. I'm not saying it's being displayed on the court, but I do think, I mean, I would be jealous if I was a vet and my league was mm-hmm. just now getting attention, more attention, I guess.
Yeah. But also I think there's kind of a welcome to the league type thing. With every league, with every sport, men or women, whatever it is, I kind of think there's always that, hey, rookie, welcome to the league. Like, you know, you're not going to be able to just come in here, walk in, and do what you did in college. We're going to show you how difficult it is here.
I can see that.
But, yeah. Angel Reese was ejected. I don't know if you saw that earlier this week. What's your take on that ejection?
It's interesting because we're talking about the physicality of the league, and there's a lot being said about how physical the WNBA is, and ironically her ejection had nothing to do with physicality. I think she gave the refs some attitude and they didn't like it, and it seemed kind of like a quick ejection. I'm sure it was justified, but the viewers don't really know the full story because it just looked like she said something, the refs didn't like it, and then when she waved it off, they threw her out.
Right, yep. Yeah. So to kind of further explain, she was given two technicals, which is an automatic ejection. The first technical she received was for basically arguing with the ref on the call that had been made. And then the second technical was as she walked away, she kind of waved off the ref in kind of like a whatever type of move. And the ref clearly didn't like that, so teed her up again. And that's what it, you know, caused her to be ejected from the game, which to me just, I don't know. I feel like there's this officiating issue, I guess maybe you want to say, in the WNBA right now. The game we just watched, Indiana and Washington were playing, and I even mentioned how just looking at both teams, there are missed calls and calls that should have been made and instances where refs weren't on the same page. One ref's calling a shooting foul, the other saying, no, the foul's on the floor on the same play. It just seems like unorganized, honestly, from what I've seen.
Yeah, to close out that thought, I think that now that there's a little bit more visibility into the WNBA, it's gotten more eyes, more viewers, I'm hoping there will just be some more accountability and maybe mm-hmm. some better training for these refs.
Yeah, maybe that's all it is that these refs are usually not the number one refs, so to speak. And so maybe you're right. Maybe this extra visibility will make the league say, hey, we need to get these men and women some more training, some, you know, film sessions, because believe it or not, refs look at film as well, just to kind of make them better, just like the league's getting better. If the players are going to get better, the refs have got to step up and get better as well.
All right, what other drama?
So this is a past one, and this is one you brought up to me that I did not know about. I think there's a lot of past dramas, if you will, in the WNBA that not many people know about because they haven't been watching the WNBA. And this one is in relation to Skylar Diggins. Do you want to elaborate on the story, or would you rather me take it?
So I think we actually don't know a ton of details about this drama. We know that Skylar Diggins Smith, I believe is her full name now, mm-hmm. Her and Diana Taurasi have had some beef on the sidelines when Skylar played for the Mercury.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that in 2023, Skylar sat out the season because she had a baby. And I guess she came back to the facilities to work out or something, but she was not allowed to enter into the facilities. And what's interesting is legally she had to be paid for that full season by the Mercury, but she wasn't allowed to use any of the facilities. She couldn't come to the court to work out. Mm-hmm. She couldn't see like the team's, not chiropractor, but like trainer. And she was technically still employed. So that
just blows my mind.
It's just confusing, I think. Yeah. And so after the 2023 season, it was a free agent, correct, I believe. So she plays for Seattle now, mm-hmm. but we know that there's something going on between Diggins Smith and Taurasi. Taurasi's been asked questions about her and she's just responded no comment.
Mm-hmm.
But then Skylar Diggins Smith back in 2023 tweeted saying she doesn't have access to massage therapists, chiropractors, chefs, strength and conditioning, nutritionist, something that every other player has accessibility to.
Right.
And it's just very confusing. And the Mercury nor the WNBA have come out and explained that. And as a mom who has been postpartum twice, you're already just kind of hanging on by a thread. You have a lot to adjust to. So to not be able to rely on your job or the benefits that come with that maybe you were relying on,
mm-hmm.
that's just tough.
Yeah. And maybe that's what she wanted to use during that time as I hate to call it a break because that may sound bad, but just a time to get away. Like, being a new mom is tough. You know that way better than I do, obviously. And so maybe she just wanted some time, an hour to go to the gym and put up some shots or get a workout in, something just to kind of clear her head.
Yeah. I also just don't know how that was legally denied from her, but I hope we learn more now that this is kind of resurfaced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Me too. I'm interested to kind of dig into this and some other former dramas, if you will, around the league in next week's Sideline Saga segment. Something else that I wanted to talk about today, and actually you were the first one that brought this up to me, is how new most of these coaches are to the WNBA. And I say new to head coaching, I should say. In fact, if you look at all of the head coaches, there's only one head coach in the league that has been there prior to the 2021 season. That's the head coach for the Minnesota Lynx. Cheryl Reeve. Every other coach is in there at most third year in the league. Is that crazy to you? Because that seems crazy to me.
I think it's wild. And I don't know the reason. I don't know if it's because they can get more money somewhere else. I don't know mm-hmm. if it's because of they're fired because their teams aren't doing super well. I would be super interested to understand why the tenure is so short. And I have tried looking up articles and it's just not really talked about But I would be curious to see like why these previous coaches were let go or why they left on their own.
Yeah, my first assumption is that historically, especially, coaching in the WNBA hasn't been the quote-unquote top job that you would strive for if you're a coach. You would typically want that head coaching job at a big-time college program. You're going to get more publicity. You're going to get more money in the past. And even now, I guess, you get more kind of endorsements as a coach. Like, I can't think of a single, I take that back, maybe one head coach in the WNBA that I've seen on any type of commercial, whereas that's not true for college. I mean, the highest paid college women's coach is Kim Mulkey. She makes over $3 million a year. The highest paid WNBA coach is Becky Hammon. She makes $1 million a year. I mean, there's a pretty big disparity. And from what I hear, there's a pretty big disparity between the top coaches in the WNBA and the bottom coaches in the WNBA when it comes to pay. I tried looking into that, and shockingly, it is really hard to find the pay for these women's coaches, these WNBA coaches, which is also something that I find very interesting.
That is interesting. On another episode, we will have to dive in deeper to the Minnesota Lynx head coach, Cheryl Reeve. Mm-hmm. So she's been with the league for 14 seasons, I believe.
Yeah.
And that's a long time, considering mm-hmm. the rest of these coaches have been around for 3 or less seasons.
Right.
So on another episode, we're going to have to talk about why she stayed. I mean, and I've never heard of her.
No, never heard
I think
of her.
The only one of these coaches that I have heard of is Becky Hammon, mm-hmm. and it's because she did some pretty radical things when she was a player when it comes to the Olympics. So
yeah, and I kind of get the feeling or the sense that Becky Hammon will be the next coach, kind of like Cheryl Reeve, where she stays in the league as a coach for a while. I feel like, I mean, she left the San Antonio Spurs as an assistant coach to come coach the Las Vegas Aces. Honestly, on the surface, it sounds like a step down, but she's won the championship every year she's been a head coach. And I kind of feel like she's
pretty great record.
Yeah, and I kind of feel like she's in a spot that she enjoys, which to me is kind of the sign of she's going to stick around for a while. Moving on. Another, we'll say, hot topic, I guess, especially in the off season for several years, it feels like, has been how WNBA players are paid in comparison to NBA players. A lot of it has focused on just straight up salary, and that's an argument that you could spend an entire podcast on. All I'm going to say is men get paid way more because they bring in way more, in my mind. And as far as just salary goes, that's kind of all I wanted to say. Anything you want to say as far as that goes?
No, but I do think we should get into, besides just what their contract says about just their flat, we'll call it salary, how do NBA players get paid mm-hmm. compared to WNBA players?
Yeah,
like, what are their forms of income?
So I did some digging looking into this and found some interesting tidbits here. So NBA obviously brings in money from jersey and merchandise sales and TV contracts and things like that. And in the current CBA, collective bargaining agreement, for those of you who don't know, which is just basically an agreement between the players and the league on how pay structures will work, splits for revenues will work, that kind of thing. The NBA league splits that TV and merchandise revenue 50-50 with the players. Not the case in the WNBA. There is a revenue split system in the WNBA, but it's predicated on them meeting certain revenue thresholds as a league. And so far in the entire existence of the WNBA, they haven't met those revenue thresholds. And so there has been zero 50-50 split or any split with the players. So the players have never gotten any cut of merchandise sales or ticket sales or any TV contracts, anything like that from the WNBA.
And that maybe doesn't surprise me so much for the ticket sales, But for merchandise sales, especially if it has, if it, there's a jersey that has your name on it, I would expect you to get some sort of cut from that.
Especially in today's world where college players are. I mean, right. You go into a bookstore and buy a football jersey with a college player's name on the back of it, that college player is going to get a cut of that in today's NIL world. And to me, it just blows my mind that, like you said, a WNBA player is not going to get anything if the fan store at the stadium sells their jersey.
Right. Yeah. I'd be interested to see if the WNBA meets that threshold this year.
Yeah.
Especially like the game that we just watched tonight, the Indiana Fever and the Washington Mystics, the Mystics had to move this game to where the Wizards play.
Yeah.
The capacity at the Wizards Stadium is 20,000 versus the 4,200 in the stadium that they typically play in.
Yep.
That's potentially 4 to 5 times the revenue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And I'm glad you brought that up because I went back and a comment that Angel Reese made this past week made me do some digging. And she made the comment that, hey, fans are here to watch other people other than Caitlin Clark. She didn't name names, but we all know who she was talking about. And basically was implying that, hey, people are coming to watch me too. And so I was like, okay, I agree with you to a certain extent. I think a lot of the new fans are here to see Caitlin Clark, but I agree with you that there are definitely some fans that have come to see players like you and Camila Cardoso and Cameron Brink and Kate Martin and others. And so I went and looked up attendance records for the last four games Caitlin Clark has played in prior to today's game. And the attendances were just under 17,500, so 17,400, just over 17, so 17,200, 15,000, and 19,000. So not a single game of her last four games has there been less than 15,000 fans at, okay? And then I looked at, in the same time span, four games that were, I thought, should have been kind of big-ticket games with teams like Las Vegas or New York or Phoenix playing. And this is what I found. The highest attended game of those was the Phoenix Mercury at the Las Vegas Aces with barely over 10,000 fans. The next best was New York at Chicago with barely over 8,000. And then you had Phoenix at Minnesota, barely over 7,000. And then Dallas at Las Vegas, barely over 6,000. That's a pretty big disparity between games that Caitlin Clark is playing in versus games that she's not playing in.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers don't lie. But getting back to this point of, you know, are they going to meet this threshold? I think it's undeniable that even if, you know, it's not a Caitlin Clark game and they're hitting this 10,000 attendance number, I can only imagine that last year it was closer to 5,000 or 6,000.
Matt, that's a very good point. Yep. Even hitting 10,000, which may seem like significantly less, actually is probably much more than what they got last year. You're right.
And so I know you said that there is a revenue split if certain thresholds are met. So is that per team or overall in the WNBA?
That's the league as a whole. So the league as a whole has to essentially bring in X amount of dollars as revenue. And once they hit whatever that number is, I couldn't find out what it was, but whatever that number is, then they kind of gain access, if you will, to the opportunity to split revenues with the league.
At the end of the season, I would love to see just the attendance leaders. I think there are some obvious ones, but I'm curious to see, I'm honestly more curious to see which markets are at the bottom, because I feel like I have a pretty good idea, but, and honestly, the Mystics were one of them, but we just saw them in a 20,000 person stadium. So there's definitely a discrepancy there. And I don't think that discrepancy as far as how players are getting paid in the W compared to the NBA. I don't think any person in the WNBA is saying that they deserve contracts like the men, like the NBA.
I would agree with that.
I don't think that anyone is saying, hey, we deserve
$100 million.
Right. The number out there, they're just saying we want to get paid in a structure that is similar to these NBA players. Mm-hmm. They know they don't bring as much money into the league, but they bring more in than what they're getting paid right now. Yeah. So,
and to kind of play devil's advocate here, the WNBA in its entire existence has not ever made a profit. And that's probably why they have yet to meet any kind of threshold for a revenue split, is because the NBA is quite literally subsidizing them. Without the NBA's money, the WNBA would not be in existence.
Yeah.
So far, this year might change that, and I hope it does. There are a couple other ways that I think NBA players make extra money that might be worth noting. The biggest one's endorsements. In most cases, the top men especially, can make, you know, much, much more in endorsement deals than they can through their actual salaries. And especially up until this year, I don't think that's been the case at all for women. I think they've maybe had two or three women that could make any money in endorsements. I think that's starting to change for a lot of them around the league.
Yeah, it's pretty exciting.
No, it is.
Yeah. Asia Wilson and Sabrina Ionescu, and I know Super doesn't play anymore, but mm-hmm. them in a CarMax commercial, and I'm seeing them in ads, and it's pretty exciting for all of them.
Yeah, I mean, I hope that it continues and that they are able to expand their reach. I feel like in the past, maybe a lot of their endorsements were more localized. Right. To their specific market, which makes sense. But
kind of like NIL.
Yeah, exactly. But I am glad that it's expanding and that now I can turn on the TV in Dallas, Texas and see a commercial with three players from all over the country, you know, together advertising a product. And I know who they are now, and I'm assuming millions of other people now who may have never known who they were now know who they are.
Right. They're becoming household names, for yes, sure.
Which is great for them, great for the league, great for women in general, especially little girls playing basketball who have somebody to look up to. It's just great all around.
And little boys,
yes. Sorry. I mean, I've got two little boys and a little girl, and I'd be happy to have them look up to any of these women.
Oh, yeah. Our three-year-old says that Clayton Clark is his favorite player. That's right. And that's pretty awesome.
Yeah. All right. Moving on, Katie. This next segment, it's all yours.
Yes. So because I don't have the history or the knowledge of basketball like you do, and I think that many, we'll just say people who are kind of new to the WNBA also probably don't have the knowledge. Mm-hmm. I wanted to talk about a few phrases that I think are commonly used. They're common basketball terms, but... Okay. I personally don't know what any of them mean.
Got it. Are we about to enter the Hoops Lingo Lab?
Okay, we'll call it the Hoops Lingo Lab. Okay, so the first one I have on here is a screen. Ooh. Can you tell us what a screen is?
Okay, a screen is something that an offensive player will do, first of all. And the easiest way to explain it is an offensive player will literally stand in position and not move to basically get in the way of a defensive player who is guarding the person with the ball and make it more difficult for them to guard that person. Or in many instances, all they're trying to do is give the guy, or girl, I should say, in this case, an extra step or two on the defender to get them open is essentially all you're doing.
So it's like a block.
Yes, that's a great way to think about it. It's like a block in football, except you can't move. You have to stand completely still. You're basically just an object that the defender has to go around.
Interesting. So you have to stay still, though.
Correct. Yes, you have to. You have to have your feet set. If you don't have your feet set, then a foul can be called on you and should be called on you.
So that would be like an offensive.
Correct. Yep.
Foul.
Yep. Offensive foul. Ball gets turned over. Going the other way.
So a screen can only be done by an offensive player, though.
I guess it doesn't technically have to only be done by an offensive player. I don't know why a defender would want to screen somebody. But yes, it is an offensive play.
So on the offensive side, the person doing the screen is essentially acting as a barrier so that their player with the ball can get a little bit more movement.
Right.
Okay. Yep. Great. I never knew that.
Yep.
Okay, so the next one is pick and roll.
Ooh, pick and roll. Okay, so this is great. Great question. because it kind of plays off of the first one, which was a screen. So pick and roll is essentially where a person on the offense will screen, so stand still, and as the offensive player goes to dribble right next to them, instead of standing there for a little bit longer to give the offensive player with the ball a little bit more space, that person will what's called roll, which is typically just they cut towards the basket. And a lot of times this is going to be dependent on what defense is being run. But the idea is to have all of a sudden there be a little bit of defensive confusion. And now that person who was screening is now wide open that the person with the ball can now just pass it to for an easy layup.
Hmm.
So the idea is that the defense isn't going to be guarding the person screening particularly hard because they're not expecting them to do anything. And then all of a sudden they pop out and are open because the defense wasn't expecting them to, and they get an easy layup.
That feels a little bit more complicated.
It's a little bit more complicated. It's kind of hard to describe in just an audio format. It would take some video or some more deep explaining that honestly I don't know that we have time to go into.
Okay, but it's an offensive move.
It is an offensive move. It's a play. Let's just call it that. It's a play.
It's a play.
Uh-huh. Involving two players in the offense.
Got it. Okay. So the next one I hear all the time, they talk about zone defense versus, what is it, man-on-man defense?
Yep, man. So man-on-man is exactly what it sounds like. You know, each person is assigned, for lack of a better term, a offensive player that you're going to guard. So I'm guarding Caitlin Clark. I'm staying with her the entire possession. Wherever she goes, I go. If she shoots, I'm trying to block her shot. I am blocking her out after she shoots. She is my person, my responsibility to guard. A zone defense, on the other hand, is where I am assigned a certain area of the court. So I might be guarding Caitlin Clark, but if she leaves my area, I don't have to worry about her. But now I have to worry about the other person who's coming to my area. So instead of guarding a specific person, I'm now guarding an area. The most common, zone defense is what's called a 2-1-2. You have two players up top near the 3-point line. They're guarding like kind of that top two, like the court's kind of split in two. You're guarding those top two spots, and then there's a person behind them in the middle called, you know, your one position, and then there's two more behind them closest to the goal, kind of covering that baseline. If we were to divide it into two sides of the court.
So that's the zone.
That's a zone.
Those are the zones.
In that specific one, yes. Yes. In the 2-1-2. You can have
in the 2-1-2.
Yep, in the 2-1-2, which I think from, you know, school kid aged basketball all the way up is probably the most common. Is your simple 2-1-2.
Okay, so how often do you think teams use man on man? Compared to zone defense.
Yeah, man is more common in the WNBA and NBA, I would say, than zone. And I would say man is more common when you're a little kid. It's easier just to tell a little kid, hey, that's your person, guard that person.
Feels like you're comparing women to little kids, I'm just telling you.
Well, no, it's common in the NBA as well.
I'm just giving you a hard time.
Okay.
That seems challenging to just stay on one person, because that one person could literally be all over the court.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So zone defense makes more sense to me, but...
Yeah, the challenge with the zone, especially in the WNBA and NBA, is that if you're not careful, you can have pretty big mismatches. You can have a mismatch where...
Like in height or like size.
Yeah, height, yeah. Skill. Yeah, exactly. You could have a post player ends up in a zone with a, you know, a guard, and if you're not careful,
posts are tall people, guards are average size.
Great, very simple explanation. Yes. basically my point is that at that higher level, mismatches can be a little bit more common if you're in a zone, so that's why they typically run a man defense or some variation of a man defense.
Got it. Okay, so last one for today. Box and one defense.
Are you asking me this because you heard me refer to this a few weeks ago?
I literally just heard someone on the TV say box, and I don't know what that means.
Okay, so box and one is kind of, it's going to get complicated, a mixture of both a zone and a man defense.
I knew there had to be a hybrid.
So
they should just call it the hybrid defense.
The hybrid defense. Okay, I'll submit that to Mr. Naismith.
Yeah.
And see what he says. Okay. So a box and one is essentially where you have four people playing zone in a box, just like it sounds, at different corners, if you will, of the court. And then the one is your person playing man.
What does that mean? Person playing man.
Person, like man on man.
Oh.
So you have one person assigned to a specific offensive player.
Okay.
And everybody else is playing zone defense.
Got it.
And typically you would do that if one player on the offense is hurting you as a team. So if one player is significantly better than everybody else, or that one player is just having a great game and just hitting every shot they make, something along those lines, you want to stop that one player. This is typically what a box of one is for, so that you can have one person guarding that player that's hurting you to make sure that they're never open, and then everybody else is kind of playing zone against the players that are not hurting you as bad.
Got it. That makes sense.
It makes sense? I explained that pretty well?
Yeah. No, that actually made perfect sense.
Okay, nice.
Thanks for the lesson, teacher Devin.
No problem. All right. Last thing I've got on the docket for tonight, unless you have something else, is the 3-on-3 Olympic team for the women was just announced this past week. Who we got? Who we got playing?
So Cameron Brink,
okay,
who I understand has played 3-on-3 quite a bit and for the U.S. team before.
Yes, I believe she was in some kind of tournament last summer.
Right. Haley Van Lith. Uh-huh. There was a pretty emotional video that was put out there for her, which is very cool. Ryan Howard, which I am not as familiar with. She mm-hmm. plays on Atlanta's team, okay, WNBA yep. team.
Name sounds familiar.
And then Sierra Burdick, who I don't think is playing for the W right now.
I am pretty sure you're correct. I don't think she's playing for the W. I don't think she has for like 2 years, if I remember correctly, since 2022. So interesting. It's interesting to me that you've got two players that, well, one isn't professional at all, and two is, you know, in her rookie season. And then two, we'll call them veterans who have played professionally before. That's the first interesting thing to me. Second is I have not seen any 3-on-3 basketball. This is the first Olympic Games where we will have it. So I'm interested to see just kind of how the flow of this works, how the gameplay works, the strategy works. That's what's going to be most interesting to me.
Yeah, no, we'll definitely be watching. I think you were telling me that with 3-on-3, if the court's smaller,
correct.
Is that right?
It's a half court, basically.
Is it really? So they're mm-hmm. shooting towards the same basket?
I believe so. Yeah, it's kind of like, have you seen the Ice Cube's Big Three League?
Well, I've heard of it, but I don't know anything about it.
Oh, okay. Well, my understanding is that it's essentially the same thing, where they are taking the court, cutting it in half. You're only playing on one half of the court.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I'm looking up Sierra Burdick, and it looks like she did play in the W for 5 years.
Oh, okay.
So she's
definitely a professional veteran.
Yeah, but it doesn't look like she's played since 2021.
Oh, 2021.
So maybe this will be a good opportunity to learn about her.
Yeah, and I'm interested to see how they compete against the rest of the world. I know in men's basketball, you've got quite a few foreign players playing in the NBA. And there are definitely some foreign players playing in the WNBA, but not nearly as a percentage goes, not nearly as many as in the NBA. So I'm kind of curious to see how we stack up against the rest of the world.
Yeah, that'll be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The one thing that I wanted to quickly discuss before we wrap up is the Commissioner's Cup.
Oh, okay.
We need to provide a little bit of an update
on
the standings.
Okay, what you got? What's the standings so far?
It's Friday night. Yep. What is it? June 7th?
Yep, that's correct.
June 7th. Not all of the games have finished for the evening, but in the Eastern Conference, we have the New York Liberty leading with 3 wins.
Okay.
Okay. And right behind them is Connecticut and Indiana tied for 2 wins.
Okay.
Indiana's lost one and Connecticut has not lost a game yet in this tournament.
Got it.
On the Western Conference side, we have Minnesota up. They are 2-0.
Huh.
And then the rest of the teams have won 1. So we don't really have quite a distinguishing leader in that side of the bracket. Got it. We'll have to have to provide another update next week when more of these games are played.
Definitely. And for those who don't understand how this works, at the end of this essentially month-long, it's not even a month.
It's not quite a month.
2 weeks. Thank you. Tournament. The team in the East that is number one and the team that is number one in the West will then face off in the championship for the Commissioner's Cup. So that'll be interesting. If things go the way they're going, I think it'll be a tough matchup or toss-up between New York and Connecticut on the Eastern side. And then on the Western side, honestly, it could be a toss-up between a couple teams.
Yeah, it should be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. It'll be interesting to see what all happens. I'm excited.
Yep.
Well, I think that should wrap it up for tonight. Thanks again, guys, for listening. This is the Crossover Conversations Podcast. We are your hosts, the Wyatts. I'm Devin.
I'm Katie.
Thanks again. Have a good one.